Welcome, everyone, to 1001 Heroes, Legends, Histories, and Mysteries. We have a very special guest with us today, Lieutenant Colonel Harry T. Stewart, Jr. I'm going to start this interview off by reading the inside jacket of Colonel Stewart's book, which is called Soaring to Glory. I just finished the book, and it's one of the best books I ever read. So, listeners, listen up, because you're in for a real treat with a living legend. Here's how the inside cover reads. The valiant fight for freedom in the air and dignity on the ground. He had to sit in a segregated rail car on the journey to Army basic training in Mississippi in 1943. But 2 years later, the 20-year-old African-American from New York was at the controls of a P-51, prowling for Luftwaffe aircraft at 5,000 feet over the Austrian countryside. By the end of World War II, he had done something that nobody could take away from him. He had become an American hero. This is the remarkable true story of Lieutenant Colonel Harry Stewart, Jr., one of the last surviving Tuskegee Airmen of World War II. Award-winning aviation writer Philip Handelman recreates the harrowing action and heart-pounding drama of Stewart's combat missions, including the legendary mission in which Stewart downed 3 enemy fighters. Soaring to Glory also reveals the cruel injustices Stewart and his fellow Tuskegee Airmen faced during their wartime service and upon their return home after the war. Stewart's heroism was not celebrated as it should have been in post-war America. But now, his boundless courage and determination will never be forgotten. Thank you for your service, sir.
Thank you, John.
It's great to have you with us today, Colonel Stewart.
It's great being here.
First question for you. What do you hope this story will inspire in our listeners?
Well, I try to point my experiences to youth, and I would hope that it would inspire youth to go ahead and follow their dreams, with tenacity. And if they find that somewhere along the route there is that the dreams can't make fruition there, is not to be ashamed to go ahead and change and have a fallback position. I think when I say fallback position, I think of a lot of high school kids that I talk to, and they talk about becoming football stars or basketball stars. I tell them, number one, I said, you know, you're fighting a hard game there because there's only so much room at the top. And I says, number two, suppose you have an Achilles tendon rupture on you during the, what do you do then, you know, and you need that fallback position. And I guess I would say as an example, that's what I did. I wanted to be an airline pilot, but I didn't quite make that. So what I did, my fallback position was when I found out that that desire was going to evaporate there, that I decided to go back to school, get my degree in mechanical engineering from New York University and went up the corporate ladder from there, and everything worked out fine.
Do you still remember the moment as a young boy you were in New York, standing near, I guess, what is today LaGuardia? What do you recall from that moment?
Well, it was inspirational from the standpoint that I said, that's what I want to do. I want to sit up in that cockpit one of these days, and I want to be able to fly this plane around. And, of course, it just about World War II came along, and I was able to qualify as a aviation cadet and got my wings and became a second lieutenant and went overseas and participated in combat in the all-African fighter group there, the 332nd fighter group, flying out of Italy doing bomber escorts.
Now, you guys doing bomber escorts, those were called the Red Tails, right?
That's correct, yes. That was the identification, and just as, do you have a picture here, there? And that's the Red Tail there on the P-51, if you can see it.
I sure do, yep.
And strictly that that had to do just with identification, that's all. All of the fighter groups that we had overseas there, including the African-American fighter group, had distinctive tail markings, so that we didn't have to use radio. We got the radio silence, but tell by the visual who was in that plane there or what group they were from.
And you guys had built quite a reputation as bomber escorts. Am I correct? They were literally asking for your group.
Yes. And that I have to attribute to General Benjamin O. Davis, our leader there, and he forbade us under fear of court-martial to never, ever leave the bombers. And that was our primary duty there, is to protect those guys in the B-17s and the B-24s and to never abandon them.
What was it like? Describe for us what it was like when you went to the Tuskegee Flight School. What challenges did you face? And did that seem like it took forever?
Yeah. Well, the challenge was, you know, to make it through each event or each progress period during the flying there. The flying was made up of four different segments of 2.5 months each, the first being pre-flight, which did not actually involve any flying there, but learning navigation and all of the radio, how to work the radio, Morse code, that type of thing. Then going into the second phase was primary, where you actually start your flying, and that was with a two-wing, a biplane, the PT-17 Stearman, and we had 60 hours in that, and if you satisfactorily got through there, you went to the BT-13, which was a more advanced aircraft, 450 horsepower engine in it. And then the last phase, which was advanced flying, was the AT-6, the American Texan, which had a 650 horsepower engine and flew very much like a fighter plane. And after that, I got my wings and got my second lieutenant's bars. I was all of 19 at the time, and I didn't have a license. No, I didn't know how to drive a car. But being from New York City, you know, you didn't need
you
a
didn't
car.
You didn't need it.
It would be a handicap, you know.
Everywhere you needed to go, you could walk to.
Exactly.
Do you still remember your first solo flight?
Yes.
And what do you remember from that? What type of plane were you in, and what do you remember from that?
Well, in that was a PT-19 Cornell. It was a low-wing, all-plywood, Ranger inverted engine, and open cockpit, and, you know, the scarf and goggles and that type of thing. But anyway, after about 7 hours, my instructor asked me to taxi over to the wind tee. And when he said that, I figured this is it. He's going to let me go. And that's what he did. And he got out and he fastened his safety belt so that it wouldn't flap around in there without him in it. And told me to go ahead and take it around and just follow the lessons that I had given him. And I did it. And when I came back in, he told me to take it around again and then a third time. And that was it for the day. But of course, that first takeoff by myself was just the most exhilarating thing I think I've ever done in my life, because I was in control, total control. I was a pilot of this aircraft that was taking off.
My sister was a pilot. I've never had that dream to go up in the air. I'd rather do 160 miles an hour on land.
Okay.
But my sister wanted to be a pilot. She took me up in a Cessna one time, and feeling the bumps and everything else, and then feeling the wind just about blow us off the runway up on Long Island. We were trying to land at a little airstrip they had out near Grumman. It scared me to death.
Okay.
Right. But I appreciate the courage it takes to get up there just to fly, much less the kind of courage that it takes to face somebody in the air who's trying to shoot you down and knock you out of the sky. And it takes a lot of courage to hold yourself together and keep going when you're facing the kind of racism that you faced as a young man trying to go forward. For some of our young listeners, what kind of challenges did you face race-wise from the time you were a young man wanting to go into the service?
Well, the main problem was, of course, the segregation itself. And the segregation meant that you'd be deprived of a lot of the prime necessities that you would normally have. being from New York at the time, the neighborhood I grew up in, it was a totally integrated neighborhood. I went to integrated school and integrated movies, restaurants, that type of thing. So going into the service and going down south there, where racism was institutional at the time, there was quite a change in the life that I knew. But the idea was I kept my eye on the prize, and the prize being, you know, being a pilot, getting to be a pilot and gaining my wings. So I subdued those strong emotional feelings that you might have in prejudice there in favor of getting what was done in order to gain my wings.
The way you told your story in the book was inspiring, because there were points, especially during the hazing process at Tuskegee, there were points during that very brutal hazing process where some of these other guys who were all trying to get to the top of the ladder so they could get their wings might have felt that they were not being fairly judged. And
yes.
You, that not happened not only once, that happened all the way through, all the way up to Las Vegas. But it always seemed that you were the one who said, you know, this is my performance. I believe I have been fairly judged. I can see why this guy made that decision. And
yes.
You were always pushing yourself to get better and not using that as an excuse. This is why I didn't score that well, or this is why I didn't achieve that. It was always you pushing forward and saying, these guys were fair. I just need to get better.
Exactly. Exactly. It was me. Right.
And that was inspiring. That's the kind of heart that everybody needs. And it took a lot of heart for you to fight both wars, the war that you fought in the air and the war that you fought on the ground. And I know that a lot of people are inspired by your story, and they're going to be very inspired by Soaring to Glory.
It's a wonderful
book in a lot of ways.
Yes. I think Philip Handelman did a great job.
What are your fondest memories of flying with the Red Tails? And can you give us some specific stories or anecdotes about that?
I guess when I got overseas, my first bomber escort mission that I had, I think I just had a couple of hours of transition in the P-51. The operations officer came out after I was at the field for about a day and gave me a manual about 50 pages thick, and it was all about the P-51 and how it ran and that type of thing. And he said, study this. And after I finished reading it for a while there, he came back and he says, now I'm going to give you a cockpit check and a blindfold check. And he said, I'm going to put this blindfold on you, and I want you to point out the various instruments that are called out. And then after I did that, he says, well, that's it. Take it. You've got to go, you know. So there was no instructor to show me how or anything like that. I had to use the past experiences so I could transition into this hot fighter plane, the P-51, which certainly was a wonderful, wonderful aircraft. But anyway, on that first mission I went on, it was about, 500 or 600 bombers that we were escorting. And these bombers, they were in trail, I guess. The trail must have extended maybe for 100 miles. And of course, the fighter planes, we were flying over a segment of these bombers. But as the bombers started rising, and I was flying tail end Charlie, I was thinking, and being the last guy in the very last rear there. So I had a panorama view of everything that was going on in front of me there. When these bombers met a certain atmospheric height there, they started pulling what we call these vapor trails. And you see them up the planes, you know, today, pull these vapor trails. Well, each one of these bombers had four engines, so each engine was pulling a vapor trail times 500 or 600 of these planes. So it was a ribbon right to the horizon. And then the fighter planes were circling above them, and in order to keep it with the same ground speed, they had this circle or weave over them there, and it was like a dollar sign going across those streams there. So it was a sight to behold, and it was something that I had never seen before, and I will never see again, because no country will ever put up an armada, air armada, like we did in World War II. And I think of today, where one bomber can do all of the damage that all of the bombers did in World War II. And as I said, it was an awe-inspiring sight to see that. And it comes back every once in a while in my memory to see that first sight that I saw going out on the bomber escort mission.
One of your Red Tail planes, was it General Davis's plane, had by request written on the nose of the plane, I believe it was.
Yes,
Because he was very proud of your unit always being called up for escort.
Exactly.
So by request. I thought that picture was pretty neat.
Yes, yeah.
During the same mission, when you took down three German planes, would you tell us about the fate of your fellow airman, Walter P. Manning? And when you returned to base safely, what did you think had happened to him when he didn't make it back? And how long was it until you found out the truth?
Well, Walter, we were in a... As I had mentioned at the beginning of our talk, I said that Colonel Davis, or General Davis at the time, there had forbidden us to leave the bombers. But under certain circumstances, if it was declared that the bombers were in safe enough territory and they were out of harm's way, we could be designated to go on what was known as a fighter sweep. And a fighter sweep would be looking for trouble, looking for targets of opportunity, like other enemy aircraft, or maybe traffic on the barge traffic on the river, or railroad trains, or other rolling stock, or something like that. Anything to impede the enemy as far as war effort was concerned. So seven of us were sent on a fighter sweep, and it was around Wels Aerodrome in Austria. We were attacked by a group of German fighters, Focke-Wulf 190s. And in the fight, of the seven of us, three of us got shot down. One was not badly damaged. He was able to get back to friendly territory in Yugoslavia and landed there. Another one of our pilots that got shot down was killed instantly. And the third one, his name was Walter Manning. He was, plane was disabled. He had to bail out. And when he bailed out, he landed amidst a mob down on the ground of civilians. And they took him and had him put in the local jail that they had. A couple of days later, or a day later, some SS troops came in, SS German troops came in and started whipping up a frenzy of hate within the populace there. And the bottom line is that this mob got together and they broke into the jail, took Walter out, beat him up, and then lynched him. They hung him from a lamppost. When I got back to the base, I didn't see this happening or anything like that. This was off to the side there, but he turned up, all we know, was missing. And I think one of the guys had seen him bail out, but that was all. There's no other report from the Red Cross or anybody else as to what exactly happened. And it wasn't until many, many years later, and I'd say when many, many years later, about 5 years ago, that the Austrian government declared that they found exactly what happened to Walter Manning, is that he was executed by a mob. The government felt that they needed to requite that situation there, and they decided to expose, and they had the moral courage to expose exactly what happened, and asked the United States, you know, to please forgive the citizen of the country for what had happened to Walter Manning. And they decided to have a memorial for him, and the government invited me over to Austria, and that was just a year ago, April 1st. And they had the memorial there, and it was quite a stirring and moving type of thing.
Could you, Colonel, describe the day that you experienced your first air combat?
Yes, that was also in Austria at the time, and we were on a fighter sweep, and I saw these two FW-190s that were in front of me and kind of low, did not see me evidently. And I was able to move up on them and had a zero deflection shot. I just put my sight on them. I hit the one man, and as soon as I hit him, I turned to the other, and I hit him, saw pieces flying off there, so I got credit for those two. But in the mean, just as that happened, I saw these white lights coming by my plane, and I looked back, and there was a German fighter on my tail, and he had his sights right on me there, and I thought that I was gone because he was in just the perfect position to go ahead and knock me out of the sky. I panicked, I would say, and I dove the plane towards the ground to get as close to the ground as possible and maneuver on the ground there. And he followed me down as such, and I started making this very, very tight turn on the ground. And all of a sudden, I looked back and I saw this big flame and big explosion. And it was evidently the fighter that was on my tail there. And evidently he over-controlled and lost control of the plane and went into the ground. So you heard the expression, God is my co-pilot. And I think that was the situation in my case because he had me dead to right. And that was, I was given credit for him as though I had shot him down. So that's how I got the three victories.
A few months ago, I did a story on the Flying Tigers of 1937, 1938, and the specific training in their P-51s for taking out Japanese Zeros.
Mm-hmm.
What was your training for going against Focke-Wulfs or Messerschmitts?
Not anything specific as far as the plane was concerned. When they talked about the Japanese Zeros, there were certain characteristics of the aircraft that you could take advantage of. With the German aircraft there, there were a number of aircraft they had. They had the 109s, they had the 190s, they had 262. And so all of them had different characteristics. So you just tried to figure out or find out what is the best way to combat them. I think that a lot of the victories that were scored during the war were people that didn't know that somebody was on their tail and was going to shoot them down. They usually got shot down by some unseen person or unseen aircraft there. So it was more or less go in and make your strike and get out of there. Right?
I live not too far from where you were born. I live a little bit south of Phoebus, Virginia. I live down in Virginia Beach. Okay. And I'm about 2 miles from the Military Aviation Museum in Pungo, Virginia, which is really in Virginia Beach. Have you ever heard of that?
No, I haven't.
I know they would be arms open to you as a guest should you ever want to come.
I would love that. Yes, I would.
They have got two Focke-Wulf 190s. They have a P-51 Mustang. They've got all types of World War II and World War I military aircraft. And it's a wonderful, wonderful museum. And a couple times a year, they have special shows. One of their summer shows is called Warbirds Over Virginia Beach.
Okay.
It's a fascinating place. It has really come of its own in the past 15 years. And I think you would really enjoy a visit.
I'm sure I would.
I don't know how much you'd enjoy standing in front of an F-190 Focke-Wulf because you had to do that once many years ago.
Well, no, I admired those aircraft there. In fact, I wish I had a chance to just fly them just as a pilot, you know, and getting the experience of a pilot to fly some of those planes. The German aircraft, they're a little different than ours, and the cockpits were a little different, and some of the flying characteristics were slightly different, but they had good aircraft, very good aircraft.
Have you had a chance in recent years to go up in any of the newer planes or in jet planes, or have you flown any?
I've been as a passenger in the fighter jet planes there, but when you talk about going into the fighters there, I do fairly frequently get up. And at 94 years old, I was up in a P-51 just about 9 months ago.
Fantastic.
And this was a P-51 that was modified, and they had two seats put in the cockpit there with dual controls.
Wow.
So that I could have controls. So I had a lot of fun going up there and doing a couple of loops and slow rolls, and just a lot of fun.
Where was that? Where's that house?
This was down in Atlanta, Georgia, at the Peachtree Airport down there. And this was a group called the CAF that owns a couple of P-51s there. And they had their one of their instructor pilots flying the plane, but he took it off. And then after he got to altitude, he turned the controls over to me, and he says, well, do what you want, you know. So that was fun.
What was it like to return to the States after the war and still face discrimination? I mean, you guys must have been flying high with all you'd accomplished, and now you come back to the States, and describe what that was like.
It was the same old, nothing had changed, and of course that was a big disappointment. And I decided, I knew there were no African-Americans flying in the airlines there, but I said, if you don't try,
you're never going to get there. Yep.
So they're never going to get there. So I did try with a couple of airlines, and I was rejected, and that was it. But ultimately, the African-Americans, these airlines, these same airlines did accept the African-Americans, and today they do have them in the airlines there. And it goes back to what I had mentioned at the beginning of the program here, is that a fallback position. And what I did at the time there is I decided it was time for me to take this fallback position of going back to school, getting my degree in engineering, and following another course of life. But of course, with that, I still was able to, you know, do my dream by still flying a little bit. And at 81 years old, I decided to add to my pilot's license there, and I got a commercial glider pilot's license, and I started flying glider pilots around and taking up local kids in the neighborhood to give them an idea of what it's like in the sky to fly, and hoping that this might inspire them to go ahead and seek some type of work in the aviation industry, because the opportunities are there that I didn't have at the time. And, you know, this could be a beginning to their developing a dream and going into aviation. And I enjoyed flying with those kids. I just loved, you know, just the response that I get. I tell this story about taking the kids up, and maybe in one day on a Saturday or something like that, it was a two-place plane, one with the pilot and one with the kid. And maybe I'd been flying maybe five or six kids, and by the end of the day there, I have one kid that I'm going to fly. And you know, these youngsters, they learn so fast. They're handling the stick, they're handling the rudder, and the next thing you know, in 10 minutes, they're able to hold the plane pretty steady and level. So what I would do on that last flight there, I would say to the youngster, I said, well, you know, you're doing so fine. I said, you're handling this so well, and you keep the plane. Just do what you're doing there, and I'm really tired after this long day. I'm going to head and take a little nap here. And, and the kid's eyes would get just as big as that, you know. I can't believe this, I guess he's saying. And, of course, I've got my eyes on him, you know. And when we get on the ground, you know, he hops out of the plane and he runs up to his parents. Mom, Dad, he let me fly the plane by myself. And you know what? He went to sleep while I was flying.
Yep. And it's easier to convince parents of that when you get older, too. So, yeah, I know the feeling.
Yeah.
I don't want to skip over. You've had a wonderful business career since getting out of the military. Can you kind of describe what you've been involved in?
I was with a few companies, two that I think of specifically, and one is Bechtel Corporation out in San Francisco. It's an international engineering and construction firm, and very gratifying in that I got to go on projects throughout the world that they were working on. And then I was a headhunter grabbed me later on and said, we have an opening in a plant in Michigan, in Detroit, Michigan, and it's a pipeline, a very, very large pipeline company. And I decided to go with them, and that's where I retired. But both those jobs are very gratifying, and they let me have my my head, the reins, as far as the job was concerned. And I finished up with the last job as a vice president of the company, vice president of administration, and that was it.
I would like you to describe the day you were honored in Washington, D.C., I believe it was in the Capitol Rotunda. Could you describe that day?
Yes. We were invited, and my wife and I, we were invited to the Capitol building, and we were to meet a number of the senators that they had there, and also some of the White House staff, and that would be George Bush, and I personally had the honor of having him shake my hand and stand right next to him up on the podium there and deliver a slight talk there. And he was a jolly guy to go ahead and talk to. As soon as I stood up next to him, he started poking me in the side with his elbow there, like he said, join the crowd here, you know. So real comfortable guy to be with, you know. But anyway, another one was Robert Byrd, who was from Virginia there, you know, and what a pleasure it was to talk to him. And he was an arch segregationist as a young man, and a member of the Ku Klux Klan, and, you know, that type of thing. And later on in life, he made an about face there as far as that's concerned, and became, you know, a real friend to the African-American citizen.
Do you think relations today have improved a lot since the mid-40s?
Oh, yes, yes.
And where do you see it the most?
Well, I see it most probably in industry. I mean, we have captains of huge business organizations now that are African-American. As far as my field in the service was concerned, I see it a lot in the airlines. In fact, I guess it was a number of years ago, maybe 3 or 4 years ago, I was taking a Delta aircraft, passenger in a Delta aircraft from, I forget where it was, somewhere in Virginia to somewhere in Kentucky or something like that. I forget. But anyway, while I was boarding the plane there, I looked in the cockpit, and there are these two African-Americans sitting in the cockpit there. That's the pilot and the co-pilot. And that's not the end of the story. Guess what? They were both female. Just amazing, you know. That's right, yes. So, yes, I've seen these changes take place in so many places, you know. And as I said, in industry and being in industry and being in the corporate world myself, I had seen those changes take place, and, you know, just big, very big, big changes. And sometimes they're not advertised or shown as much or displayed as much, but they're there. And there are opportunities, and I'd like our youth to know that, you know, there are opportunities for them, and don't use the excuse that, well, they're not going to hire me or that type of thing, you know. Get the dream and go after it, you know, and work hard for it, and don't try to get by with, you know, try to maintain excellence in all that you do.
What role did the Tuskegee Airmen play in the desegregation of the U.S. Air Force?
I think they played a primary role in it. When the integration was declared, you know, just a month before that, the three representatives, three pilots from the 332nd Fighter Group, or the Tuskegee Airmen won the first United States Air Force fighter gunnery meet that was held out at Las Vegas Air Force Base, now Nellis Air Force Base, in Nevada. And this was, they had won the best, or had become the best among the best. And not to say that the African-American pilots were better than other pilots or anything like that. They had their day as far as winning the contest was concerned, better known in the Navy as Top Gun. But they had their day there at Las Vegas. And I think that the powers that be took a look at that situation and said, look, we're wasting a lot of money with this segregation. And number two, we're compromising the abilities of a lot of people with this segregation here like this. Let's do away with this and let's go after an Air Force that's going to be the best and is going to accept all, you know. And soon afterwards, the other services followed. So I think it was a test that proved itself to be, you know, beneficial. That was that of the Tuskegee Airmen.
It was guys like you, it was guys like Jackie Robinson, who really broke their way up through the ranks the hard way, and they held to their dream. And we all owe you a debt of gratitude for what you put up with.
Well, thank you.
It's good to see that there's been so much positive change. Colonel, I was hoping you could share the story with me about being outgunned by a young lady in a fighter plane.
Yes. Anyway, I was still training and taking fighter training in, I was taking it in Walterboro, South Carolina. And I was flying P-47s at the time. And that was the last plane I would fly before going overseas. But anyway, during the end of the training that I was taking there, we were usually assigned a cube of space in the sky. You know, it might be so many miles wide, so many miles high, and so many miles long. And that was your space where you could do what you wanted in that space and not worry about the other aircraft. However, if another aircraft came through that space there, you considered that space as being sacrosanct, and this person had no business in being in there. So what you might do is challenge them and say, how dare you try to come through my airspace? And, you know, I'm the king of this airspace. And you have their signals that you can use, like the way you rock your wings and things like that, to say, let's get into a mock dogfight. And the mock dogfight being nothing but to see who can get on the other's tail. And your idea would be to keep that person from getting on your tail, from shooting at you. And the idea is you to get on their tail so you can shoot at them. Of course, this is just mock warfare, that's all. So anyway, the strange P-47 was coming through the territory there, and I challenged it. And I rocked my wings, and we got on into what's known as this Loughberry. We were turning, trying to get on one of the tails. And before I know it, this plane had gotten on my tail, and of course, I gave up. I said, okay, you got me, you shot me down. You know, I could signal it with what I did with the wings of the plane there. So this person headed, straightened up and started heading back towards the air base where I came from there. And I was heading in the same direction. So this person finally got to the air base and they landed. And I got to the air base and I landed. And this person taxied up to the revetment. And I taxied up to the revetment not too far away from them. And they stood up in their cockpit there and took their hand up and took their helmet off, and this flaming red hair fell down around the girls. Just, she was a Women's Auxiliary Air Force pilot.
Wow.
And she was ferrying aircraft. There were about 700 and some of them during the war. And they were like the Tuskegee Airmen. They were in a lot of cases not wanted and things like that because they were female and kind of destroyed male ego and that type of thing with the great flying that they were doing. But anyway, that cooled me down a lot as far as I was concerned there. I was shown a thing or two as far as this young lady was concerned, had the big joy of meeting a lot of her compatriots a year and a half ago out at Oshkosh, Wisconsin, which is, you know, the foremost air show that they have in the United States here, and a contingent of those women who were flying at the time were there. So I got a chance to speak to them and talk about this incident.
Fantastic. Colonel, could you describe the time that you bailed out and landed in Butcher Hollow?
Yes.
I love that story.
I was on my way back from South Carolina, from Shaw Air Force Base to my base in Columbus, Ohio. I had gone down there to join a group to put on some maneuvers, Army Air Force maneuvers. And I did have some ammunition on the plane coming back. I had quite a few rounds of 50 caliber machine gun bullets on the plane. Anyway, I ran into a terrible thunderstorm, and I started having engine trouble. And to make a long story short, it ended up with my bailing out. And the plane hit the ground near in Butcher Hollow, about 100 yards from the house or the cabin that Loretta Lynn was born in. And I landed maybe a half mile away or a mile away on the hillside. It was raining very, very heavily. I was injured. I had broken my leg. But I was safely on the ground. A young girl saw me, evidently a five-year-old girl, and told her father, this eagle just landed up on the hill up there. And he got a horse, and he was on a horse, and he brought an empty saddled horse and came up on that hill. And when he saw me, if you could see the expression on his face, and of course, I probably had the same kind of expression on my face. You know, that's the last thing you would dream of seeing is this African-American sitting up there in a flying suit on the hill. So it was amazing. So the whole countryside started turning out, you know, as I was going back to his cabin. And I was just treated royally. But what brings this up is many, many years later, this happened in 1948, I think it was, and many years later, around 2005, a young man by the name of Danny Blevins called me from Van Leer, Kentucky, and he said he'd been searching to find the history of my bail out there and just what the facts were. And he said there were so many rumors going around as to what happened, he didn't know what to believe. And I said, what were the rumors? So he said, the rumor was a black man stole a B-52, and he was on a bombing raid over the town, and they called up the American jet fighters, and they shot him down. Well, I fell off my chair just laughing, you know, how rumors can go. It sounds typical how rumors can go, you know, and how they get built up. But, you know, it was a year later that I was invited to Van Leer, Kentucky, and they made me the parade marshal of their homecoming. And I had the most delightful 5 days there in Kentucky, in the backwoods there that you can ever imagine. So
very nice. And, a good ending to that.
Yes, it was a good ending of that one.
Do you have any other good stories or anecdotes that we can cover?
Well, let's see. Well, I know when I used to come back, I was thinking about these missions that we were on. They would be long-range missions, and the longest one I can think of that we were on was a mission to Berlin, which was 6.5 hours. But it wasn't necessarily that mission, but a mission similar to it. The P-51, a fighter plane, was the ones in World War II were very small and had very cramped cockpits there. And even a guy my size, who I was 5'8", and I don't think I was any more than 140 or 145 pounds. I was really cramped in there along with all of the paraphernalia, the life raft and life vests and other things that I might wear. And because of the cold altitude, the layers of clothes and that type of thing. So I say all this to say that during the flight there, my seat would get very, very, very tired. It'd start aching, you know, and I didn't think a person sitting down in one spot for a long time could have their rear ache as much as it could. And what I would do was, coming back off the mission sometime, if we were in a phase where they were releasing us from the bombers there and they were saying that you can go and find your way back home now, I would turn the aircraft on its back upside down and I would hang by the seat belt, and it was like somebody giving your back a massage, and I just say, this is delightful. I couldn't stay that way very long, but that was one of the things that I could remember in flying those long missions like that.
One of the things I really appreciated in your story was the number of times you referred back to your flight crews in terms of how important these guys were to the mission, whatever it was. Can you remember any of the key people that you really became close with, guys that you felt you owed your life to?
Well, yes, there's my crew chief, no question about it. I depended on him wholeheartedly for the safety in that plane. And as far as I was concerned, I used to sort of defer to him and say, this is your airplane, you know, and you're giving me permission to go ahead and fly it. And of course, that would make him feel good, but it was true, is that while I'm in the sack, you know, sleeping and that type of thing, he's under that plane, dropping the wing tanks or doing this to the engine out in the cold weather and that type of thing. There was no hangar to be in. He was out in the open there. So he has to deserve a lot of credit. And then there are the other support personnel that were over there, because, you know, it's like we talk about Tuskegee Airmen, and you want to find out, well, how many of these guys were there? Well, I can give you a figure, like maybe 15,000. And you say, my God, where did they come from? Or that type of thing. Well, I'm talking about cooks, doctors, nurses, bottle washers, truck drivers, mechanics, everything that's required to go ahead and keep the plane flying. And they used to use an empirical formula, like there would be somewhere like 12 or 13 people just to support one aircraft, one fighter plane there. So that's why we say anybody that was involved with that type of operation, and they were absolutely critical, we call them Tuskegee Airmen. And we have the combat pilots, and they were just a few of them, and of the combat pilots that we had in the 332nd of the Tuskegee Airmen, about 531 went overseas in the combat. Something like 80 lost their lives overseas, 35 were taken as prisoner of war, shot down, taken as prisoner of war, 7 were what they call escapees. They were shot down over enemy territory, but managed to get back home without being captured by the enemy. And can you imagine a black person in Europe being shot down and being able to get out of the country without being discovered? You know, that's pretty good.
That's very good.
The name Tuskegee Airmen, that's no official name whatsoever. How that came about is that there was a doctor by the name of, last name was Charles, who wrote a book called The Tuskegee Airmen back in 1972. And for want of a title, he said, what do they use? He says, well, all of them trained down at Tuskegee, Alabama. So I'll call them the Tuskegee Airmen. And that's how that name. Good.
I think we've about got it. Is there anything you'd like to wrap up with?
What happens at... it'll be 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, and I'll jump out of bed and I say, I should have told them that's
me
it.
Me too. Believe me. Right. Yeah, me so, too. I'll be doing the same thing on the drive back to the office. I'll be, easy. A pleasure meeting you. You've got a friend forever. And I got a hunch I'll be seeing you in the next few weeks or months. I want our listeners to know how much this book, Soaring to Glory, is a fantastic read from the first page to the last. It's Soaring to Glory, a Tuskegee Airman's firsthand account of World War II by Lieutenant Colonel Harry T. Stewart, Jr. All I can say is it's a fantastic book, and I want to thank you so much for being with us today, and I want to thank you so much for your service, for being an inspiration to so many people. Thank you, Colonel.
And thank you so much for having me on your program. I've really enjoyed it.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.